Linda?
Michael? Hi. My phone just didn't even ring. I was just sitting here, and it's been doing that lately. I don't know what's wrong with it, but I heard the voicemail ring, and I went, "What the heck? Okay, I missed this call." How are you?
Well, life is interesting in this moment. It's generally good. And
Okay.
how about you?
Oh, same. I could say the same. Where do you live? You said you're an hour
Well,
later than I am.
I currently live in New Hampshire.
Ah, okay.
And I wouldn't normally be in New Hampshire, except about 6 years ago, my daughter called me and said, "Hey, you're going to be a grandpa. I'm having twins."
Oh.
And
That's
she
wonderful.
lives in Massachusetts, which is about 45 minutes away from me. And at the
Sure.
so I just basically I had been divorced by then. In fact, I get along great with my ex-wife and mother of my two children. In fact, my ex-wife called me and she says, "Well, I'm heading out to Massachusetts to be with my daughter. I'll tell you what it's like." And we lived
Yes.
in Colorado for many years, Durango, Colorado. That's
Sure.
where we raised the kids. And she called me, says, "Well, it's just a lot like Colorado, a lot of trees, not so many mountains, but a lot of trees." And so the next thing you knew, I was basically selling off pretty much everything I owned, loaded up a van and a small trailer, and I was actually living in Lake Havasu City at the time with a brother who my parents had lived there and passed on in Lake Havasu City area. So I found myself living in the desert for a few years and basically headed east. Next thing you know, I was landing in New England and found myself liking New Hampshire better than Massachusetts. So, and that's,
Oh,
like
okay.
I said, only 45 minutes away from her. So that worked out.
Yeah.
It's been about 6 years.
So what's she
What's
have? What's she
that?
have? Twins, what, boys or girls?
One of
Or
each.
both? Oh, okay, fraternal twins. Okay,
Yeah,
lovely.
pretty handy for sure. And then, in fact, you're in the Prescott area, right?
I am.
And my ex and I, we traveled quite a bit in small aircraft just because at the time we were living in Big Bear. You remember old Big Bear?
Oh, sure. Sure, sure.
And we were actually keeping our eyes open for another place to land, and we were up and down the coast and inland, and we almost moved to Prescott before moving to Durango.
Oh, we love it here. Yeah.
Yeah, so you how long you been in that area?
We've been here for 5 years. Moved here, of course, from Los Angeles, where we both worked. And so we're retired and we just love it here. Really, very ensconced in the area. My husband is a drummer. He has a local band and they play all over here. And
I tell you, I mentioned this in Facebook that we have a little bit of synchronicity between the two of us. And in fact, that's the word I use in the book that I will eventually get published, synchronicity. And I'm sure you've experienced a lot of synchronicity in your life with your experiences. But I'm a drummer also.
Oh, that's funny.
It's tonight I'm playing a gig.
Oh, that's crazy.
I'm
So,
actually
do you have a band that you belong to, or?
I do. I actually fill for. I'm actually in one. It's a Grateful Dead cover band.
Ah, okay.
And I fill in for other bands when sometimes they need drummers. At this point in my life, I'm 70. I think I'm about your age. Maybe a few years older than you. I'm 71. I'm a 52 baby.
Now I'm a 54 baby.
Okay. And I'm just at the point where. And I'm sure your husband might go through the same phases, but sometimes I go, "I don't need to work this much," you know, where you're still coming home at midnight or 1 in the morning. And so what I've found, Linda, is I'm also doing a thing that's called, you've heard of open mics?
Sure.
Yeah,
Oh, sure.
so I'm a host drummer for numerous open mics, and those are a little easier to take because you show up, you play the first set, maybe two, with the house band and a couple of people that have signed up to play. And then if there's other drummers in the house, I step aside and let them do a set or so each drummer. And I get paid the same amount as a gig.
You know, Cliff did that too. There's a, it's a, what is it? A jazz. They do jazz stuff, open mic at this big bar. And, he did that for a while, but, he didn't like it because, well, first of all, he said, I'm not bringing my own drums because he has a nice Gretsch kit. And, when he lets other people sit in, they always ruin it. You know, they scratch it up or ding it or whatever, you know. So the guy actually bought some drums for Cliff to haul, you know, to the gig. And that was okay, but he wasn't crazy about that. You know, they have the band that he has is just a rock and roll band. They do, as a matter of fact, they do a lot of music that no other band does here. They do some Led Zeppelin and they do some Jackson Brown and they do some Eagles and they do Chicago. They do a lot of stuff, you know, and they're actually very, very good. And they're getting a pretty good following. But, that's really funny, you know. But, you're talking about not working so hard. All the guys that are in the band are about the same age, so they don't want to work so hard. So, and here in Prescott, they roll the sidewalks in at 10 o'clock. So most of the stuff that he plays will be either, you know, 6 to 8 or 6 to 10 or 7 to 8 to 10. So, so that's what they do. They don't want to work so hard. They don't want to work more than twice a month.
There you go.
They don't want to, you know, do it like every day, every weekend. They don't want that because they're, you know, they're all retired and they just kind of want to play when they want to play.
Yeah.
And when Cliff plays the drums, you know, he says he plays more efficiently now. You know, before he used to be, he said when he was a kid, he just played crazy, you know, and exert a lot of energy. But now he plays efficiently. But he's a damn good drummer, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
You know, I've known a lot of drummers, you know, flying the bands for 13 years. So
exactly.
He's really good.
Yeah. Well, good. Yeah. So, well, and it's good exercise, too, as you know.
It's exactly. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You do have to be in pretty good shape, you know, to last, you know, the whole night.
Yeah. In fact, I know that if I lay off more than a month and I come back, that third set just about kills me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, geez, I'll bet. Yeah. Yeah, I'll bet.
So, Michael,
I know that you flew the bands as well. You had a Viscount, right? That you were touring with.
I had a Fairchild F-27.
Oh, Fairchild. Okay. Because we saw a Viscount and somebody was flying Jimmy Buffett. I flew Jimmy Buffett, but I didn't know who this other person that was flying a Viscount. I know. You know? Did you know Duke Morton?
Yeah, I don't, you're going to bring back names just like your book brought back so many names that it's just like, oh my God. Yeah, that's right. I knew that one.
I remember that person. Yeah. Well, Duke Morton had a Viscount and he specifically and just flew, Earth, Wind & Fire.
Okay. Was it the one with the stars and stripes on it? It was looked like an American flag.
I don't think it did. No, there was another one that we saw pictures of with Jimmy Buffett, like I say, and that one I think had stars and stripes on it. So we're trying to figure out who the heck that Viscount belonged to, because I didn't know who they were. It was you.
It was me that booked it because I handled all of Jimmy's stuff. If I didn't fly him myself, I was the agent behind it.
Okay.
So I was it was probably a Viscount that you flew. I think you guys flew for me once. I booked through Ron.
Correct.
I think it was like in 87 or I think it was in the mid 80s somewhere.
I think it was earlier than 87, but yes.
I had Jimmy for when I first started flying him in the original cheeseburger airplane. 1978 was the Fairchild F-27 that I operated and actually hired Buzz from
Buzzaroo
from your place to work with the pilot that I was training, a captain. I didn't have enough time, so I knew, I had enough sense to know that I don't belong in the left seat of this thing. And I, you know, so I flew co-pilot mostly, even though after getting some time, I was in the left seat. But yeah, Buzz came out and we flew for a couple of years in that airplane off and on for a few, quite a few tours with Jimmy before that ended up getting sold off. And then at that time, Linda, I realized operating airplanes, as you know, you could, as all it takes is, in my case, just a couple little things that needed to be replaced, and there goes my profits.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, Ron Clark's organization, we, all our pilots were AMPs. And, you know, they repaired the planes and did the checks and so forth, you know, on the road. The big ones, you know, with the airplane would come in. And if it was during a tour, then they would just replace the airplane, you know. But, yeah, you're right. And that's why Ron did it right with AMPs, you know.
Right. And I was, as a matter of fact, Linda, can I ask you something right up front? Because this, I'm taking notes, but it's so hard sometimes when I get some insightful information, I'm reflecting back and I go, oh, I wish I would have recorded that. Can I, do you mind if I record what we're talking about? And I guarantee you that none of this stuff will hit the online without.
No, it, I don't mind.
And if some things that you may find, because I do have somewhat of an interview style, because I interview like road managers and get information about some of their flashbacks, and I'm putting some of those recordings on my blog eventually.
Yeah, okay.
And if there's something that you could use for your marketing purposes or whatever, be more than welcome to it, that sort of thing.
Thank you. Okay.
What I was thinking is we're talking about maintenance on the road. Oh yeah, I did fly, and ironically enough, you were on one of the planes I flew in. It was a short trip, and it was in your book, and it was one of those, I'm one of those first officers, can't remember who it was.
Oh, what tour was that?
Lou Rawls.
Oh, Lou Rawls. That was a short one. Yeah, I think it was a week or two.
It was just a week.
Oh, and, gee, I wish I had known that. I'd put you in the book.
I wish I would have known about your book earlier. I was just turned on to it through a Jimmy Buffett thread. That, you know.
That's funny.
And, yeah, so I was an AMP and an AI. I worked at a Brackett Airport maintaining a couple of flight schools.
Okay. Uh-huh.
I was never an ATMP, ATP, rather. I was a CFI, and I would commute from Brackett over to Burbank, do the trip, come back, and still maintain a couple of flight lines at Brackett Airport. I just remembered another couple ones that I was flashed back on. Once I got into your book, I go, oh my God, okay, that makes sense. The Commodores, I flew with Finnegan.
Oh, Finnegan flew the Commodores?
That's when Lionel Richie
Ross
was.
Ross flew the Commodores. Yeah.
Lionel Richie was with them.
Yeah. Oh, yes, it was. Of course, when Lionel Richie was with them. But I thought that was Ross. Ross
actually,
and Karen.
Well, maybe they did a couple of them with them, but it was Finney with me, and we were on that one for, I think it was a couple of weeks. We ended up in Lionel Richie's house at the end of the tour, and he sang Lady on his piano before it was released.
Oh, isn't that fun? That's a great story for your book.
Yeah, well, that is part of the book, and so that's why I appreciate me twisting your arm about your approach and what you found worked for you, and if you were to do a couple things over again, what would you do different in the publication? That sort of thing. But before I could ask you that specifically is, do remember Finnegan, because you talked about Finnegan doing practical jokes like a lot of us did on the road.
Yes.
And his with me, because I did remember sitting in the, you know, going through the whole flight school I forget whose apartment it was. Was it Finnegan's apartment in Burbank, or did you guys just rent an apartment?
It was Chuck, was my husband, Chuck Volman. He was probably the teacher, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was my husband.
Okay. And I was sad to hear that he passed on.
He did pass. And Buzz passed away as well.
That just blows my mind. You know, Linda,
I know.
It's crazy. So I just remember Finnegan's practical joke on me on the Commodores tour was back in the days when the hotel rooms had a little gap underneath the door, in the front door.
Yes.
He would slide a roll of firecrackers with shaving cream and lit it off in the room.
Well, I told you that's what he did in the Batmans in my book. You know, he unlocked the door, he picked the lock, and then opened the door just slightly and threw the firecracker. He was trying to throw the firecrackers in, but I knew Michael, you know, too well. I slammed the door. He got stuck with the firecrackers on his side, popping.
He was a pyromaniac.
Oh, he was. He loved cherry bombs, and he would throw them under somebody's car, and oh, he was just horrible. Yeah. Finnegan lives here. I mean, not here in Prescott. He's in where he's from. Anyway, he's not that far away. I'm
Sholo?
Still in contact with
Maybe
him.
Maybe Sholo or no?
No. Kingston? Not Kingston. King something. Anyway, I'll come up with it. I'll let you know. But it's not that far away from here. And he comes here for the VA hospital, and so I see him. He comes. We and I have him over for lunch. And, I'm in contact actually with mostly everybody that I flew with.
The other synchronicity we had was you weren't on this plane, but we were the second bird out, and Chuck, your ex-husband, was captain. I was sitting in the right seat for the Elvis pickup.
I don't think Chuck flew Elvis. The two airplanes?
Yeah,
the
there
two
was
that
two.
Went out when Elvis died?
You, you have it in your book, and I remember.
I do, yeah. But I didn't think
and
Chuck
you did
was
mention
in the
Chuck
anyway,
being
said,
in that second plane.
Well, we had the crewing company at that time, Great Basin Aeronautical.
All I know.
We flew under Part 91.
Right, and we were on our. Yeah, definitely. We were on our way out, and. I don't know if it was Birdman or somebody in the office said, gave a, you know, radio contact and said, return to, and we'll tell you what's going on. So we ended up flying back and found out that he offed himself.
Yes.
And I was kind of bummed. I go, shit, didn't get to fly Elvis that day.
Yeah, right. we did other Elvis tours, you know, with the two airplanes with, the backup band in one airplane and the concessionaires in another airplane. Of course, Elvis flew in his own Convair 880. I had sent the airplane out because I had all the, you know, a crew signing crew contracts and so forth. And I sent everybody out and they left. I went home and my sister called me and she said, the colonel called and said, send the airplanes back. And he didn't tell us why. He wouldn't say why. So that bird had to tell me to bring the airplane back.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Come back. One airplane already went all the way to Portland.
Right. That wasn't us. Yeah. I was in the other one.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you came back and didn't you stop in Las Vegas to refuel, I think it was, and then come back to.
Yeah. We weren't that far out, but. It was definitely kind of.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah. You had the backup band with you. Was it the backup band? So anyway, they came off the airplane, and I knew these people from before, and they were asking me, you know, what happened. And by that time, we found out that Elvis was dead. And they didn't know, nobody on the airplane knew, you know. And then I was telling them all, you know, yeah, he's dead because they say, you know, that it was heart failure, respiratory failure, and that sort of thing. And everybody was kind of standing around looking at each other, you know, and I said, I think he killed himself.
Uh-huh.
And then they went, yeah, we do too. You know, and then because that book had come out, Elvis, What Happened? And I knew that he, you know, was not real happy about that because a lot of secrets had come out about him that he really didn't want the public to know.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, you know, this guy, he was like a doctor. This guy, he knew what pills to take, when to take them, when, you know, he knew when to stop peeing. And when he was just so, you know, tanked up on drugs. But
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. So I didn't realize you were on that airplane. That's hysterical. So I probably had you signing one of those contracts. My problem is that I had all my records were in a really tall metal filing cabinet. And when Chuck and I moved from Arkansas to Florida, there were just some things that we just couldn't bring with us. So we put them in storage. And that storage flooded.
Ugh.
So Chuck had gone back and they just threw everything out. So when I wrote the book, I didn't have any records to go by. All I had were some itineraries. I had all my pictures. Yeah. But gosh, if I had had, because we had the crewing company, so I did all the paperwork.
Yeah.
And it was just a big fat drag that I didn't have any of that, that documentation that I could have written a more complex story, and I know you probably later on going to ask me how I wrote the book, so I won't go into it right now. But what other question did you have for me? I don't want to ruin your.
Oh no, no! I appreciate that insight, and I feel your pain because I had lost some of my records too, and I was going to compliment you on the fact that at least you saved some pictures. You know, that's an important part of it.
I had a bunch of pictures, and also Chuck had a bazillion pictures because he started flying the bands from 75, and he had all. He was a bit of a photographer. So he had all the negatives. He had books. He was very, very organized. So he had books and books and books and books and books of negatives. He took pictures of these bands like Deep Purple and The Who and Yes on stage. And he never really developed them. He just had all the negatives. And so he had them in a couple of huge boxes, and he brought them. He gave them to me. He said, "You hold on to them." So I said, "Okay, fine." When we divorced, like us, like you. Yeah. We were still very close after our divorce.
Oh, good.
And so I put them, I had a storage shed that I put them in, and then the storage shed started leaking. And I kept fixing it and fixing it and fixing it. And then finally I just said, I don't want to be responsible for these pictures, because the roof is leaking and I don't want them to go bad. I have no other place. So when Chuck came to visit one time, I said, take them with you, So he took them back, and he lived in Idaho. And when he passed away, everything just went. I have no idea. Even his son, Colton, asked me where the pictures were. And I told him, I said, I don't know what happened to them. He said, oh, my gosh, he had such comprehensive pictures. I know. I said, I wish I had them for my book.
Yeah.
But I don't. So I gave them all back to him, and they're gone. I have no idea. I think, maybe his niece on the other side. Because he lived near his ex-brother-in-law. And I think the daughter took all that stuff. So his daughter.
Yeah, you just never know, as you know, with the hand-me-downs of kids. Like I remember having a storage shed full of really nice antiques and stuff, and I got my son and daughter together one day and says, "Okay, I'm holding on to the stuff for you guys," and they both look at me and go, "Dad, we don't want that."
They don't want pictures. They don't want anything. I know. I don't have any children, but I have nieces and nephews, and I have a whole bunch of family pictures, and tried to, gave them all to my sister. She goes, "I don't want this crap." The kids didn't want it. I said, "Well, these are family pictures that we're passing down, So I took a lot of those pictures and actually scanned them and made DVDs and such, CDs rather, and put them in my computer, the pictures that I liked and, the pictures that I felt needed to be passed on.
Right.
And, but all the other pictures are in boxes that my sister has, and she's probably going to just toss them.
Yeah.
Yeah. The kids don't want that stuff. They don't, it's a garbage to them. They want new things and want to make their own memories and all that stuff. So.
Right. Yeah. Right. So the book itself. So to me, I look at it as though not only Linda's experience, but she's actually writing a history of Go.
Oh, I did. Yeah, absolutely. You're right.
So that's a documented history of the Viscount Aircraft Go Enterprise as well as Linda.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So did you feel, did you start on the book and pretty much finish it right away? Or was it something on the back burner for you also like me?
It was never on the back burner. I used to tell stories, the stories that are in the book, to friends, and everybody would say, "Oh, you have to write a book." And I go, write a book. I wouldn't even know where to begin. I don't have any documentation. Like I said, it all got lost. And I thought, oh, I'd buy that book. If you told those stories, I'd buy that book. And I thought, I really don't have that many stories to tell, you know, really. And so I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to write the book. My husband kept pressing me, you know, write a book, write a book, write a book. So I said, okay, I'm going to go sit down and see what I can do, you know, put my mind to it. So I got all the pictures out that I had, and I would look at a picture and go, oh, that's when we were in so-and-so, and then we went bowling, and it was somebody's birthday, I remember, and I had a birthday cake, and we did this, and, you know. And so I started remembering those stories. So I would take the picture, and I would scan it, and I would put it onto a Word document. I'd write the story around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did with all the books, all the pictures that reminded me of a story. And so then as I would write the stories, I would think, God, this really is not enough. Who's on that tour? Let me think. And then I would, I started writing down, okay, the road manager was so-and-so, and then this person was that. And so I there were some things I couldn't fill in, like who was on that tour? What was his name? I would go online and see if I could find out who actually was on that tour. And then I would see that so-and-so was a lead guitar. Oh, yeah, it was so-and-so. And then I would fill that in. Uh-huh. And then after that, I started thinking, gosh, you know, are there stories online about this band during, you know, this time and where were they? And, you know, so then I started to do like a historical picture of what was going on around the band at the time. Any information that I could get, you know, that would be useful to my book, I used it.
Uh-huh.
Just to kind of fill in the blanks, you know. And then I, you know, I knew how important the Viscount was to aviation. I mean, it was just, you know, really, really very important to aviation. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do a history of the Viscount, because what the main question that people used to ask me when I told them I flew rock and roll bands, I go, oh, what kind of a jet was it? And I would have to laugh, you know, and think, it wasn't a jet. It was a turboprop airplane, if you can believe that. Uh-huh. Turboprop. You know, then I would have to explain to them that it was more economical to fly a turboprop because we did short hops and blah, blah, blah. And they always found that interesting. So I ran with that.
Yeah.
You know, whatever they found interesting, that's what I decided to write about. And then with the Viscount, then I started thinking, whatever happened to that airplane? You know, 150 RC, which used to be 898, what happened to that?
Right.
And so I started, I looked up, you know, because there's a site for Viscounts. And so then I did research on each Viscount on where it wound up. You know, 200 RC went in the side of a mountain. And,
Weird.
So I found that a lot of people loved the idea of finding out what happened to a particular airplane, you know, that these bands were on. So what I did. And you read it. You read the book, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. And that's insightful what you just said there. You found people that were interested in, okay,
exactly.
What did happen to that airplane? And
right.
The only one I know is a cheeseburger F-27. What happened to it? And that's, I don't know of what happened to a lot of the other aircraft, because a lot of the other aircraft, Linda, I would actually broker out to people like yourselves.
Yes, right, exactly.
So I could tell the story from a couple of the planes that you had given history to. But the only one that I knew of that I personally operated was the F-27. It ended up in Puerto Rico. It was never a commercial airplane, if you can imagine that. It was one of the few out of Fairchild that was a corporate aircraft owned by Hubbard Broadcasting out of St. Paul, Minnesota. It was back when they used to have, you know, separate broadcast affiliates around the whole United States. And Hubbard Broadcasting, it only had, when I got the airplane, and it was purchased through a backer that I had, And I ended up leasing it back through the backer and then subletting it to the band, to Jimmy. And it was a straight 91D deal back then. Uh-huh. That only had, if you can imagine, an airliner of that nature, a commuter airline, had 5,000 hours on it.
Oh, wow.
Very low. And so when after many years after having not flown Jimmy in the F-27, I was hired by a legal team to investigate a Fairchild F-27 in Puerto Rico through some sort of crash investigation or something. I was hired on as a legal consultant for the Fairchild aircraft. Mm-hmm. I flew to Puerto Rico. I'm on the ramp inspecting the aircraft that I was sent down there to inspect. And I'm looking across the ramp, and I'm going, wow, that airplane, that's got the same paint scheme as the old cheeseburger F-27. It is the old F-27.
Oh, funny.
I walked over to it, Linda. It must have had a bazillion. It was on a commuter. It had been flown as a commuter. Beat the crap.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This airplane was so immaculate inside. It was a custom flight deck.
Wow.
And now the thing was just, I walked inside and I almost started crying, just going, oh, my God.
I was
going to
say, did you cry?
It was just sad to see a dilapidated, what was once a very cherished airplane sitting on the ramp. So
exactly. I know how you feel. Exactly.
Yeah. So that I reflected that in your book when you start talking about where did the planes go.
Yeah.
So back to the getting the book done for me. I mean, I'm always thinking, oh, I can't get the book done yet. I'm still flashing back on this episode. Oh no, I got to write these little notes down. Oh no, that happened. That happened.
Yeah.
I got more damn notes that they're going along with the chapters that I'm finally pretty well have put together. But for a couple years during my divorce back in 2001, right in there, right around 9/11, I had published a magazine called Air, the Aviation Journal, that was came out quarterly. And I worked on it for just a couple of years just to keep me busy during my divorce days. And it was a nice slick magazine. It was pretty much about all private aircraft. The magazine was distributed through FBOs, that sort of thing.
Nice.
But that what I'm reflecting on regarding publishing the book is the magazine needed to get out. So I didn't have a problem meeting the timeline, getting it done.
Right.
But no, with my own book, talk about procrastination.
I understand. Yeah.
How did you get over that? Procrastination.
Well, you know what? Yes, I know that was the toughest part because, well, gosh, you know, the last tour I flew was 89. So now we're talking 2015, 16, you know. To write the book. And my husband was still going to work every day. And so for me, we had an office. We had a three-story house. And for me, we had an office on the second floor. So I thought, I'm going to treat this like a job. I'm going to go in the morning. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to write. I'm going to take a lunch. And then I'm going to write. And then I make dinner when my husband comes home. That's what I did. I treated it like a job. And that I knew I need to get in there at a certain time. And I needed to sit down and, you know, do what I needed to do with the book. And that's pretty much the way I did it. Because once I got into it, because for me, I'm very organized. And so I'm just trying to organize in my head, how am I going to write this? How am I going to do the chapters?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the hardest part for me, was deciding how to put the chapters together and to be what's the word I'm trying to say? I want to do everything exactly the same way. Like, you know, in the beginning, just say who the people were on the flight,
right.
You know, and then started talking about it, you know, and consistent. I couldn't think of the word. I wanted to be consistent in each of my chapters.
Right.
And then if I talked about the Viscount, was I going to have a separate chapter for that? Was I going to talk about the Viscount while I was in that particular chapter? Those were the most difficult things for me. And once I started writing, putting down on paper the stories, I started to see, you know, the similarities between all the stories. And then from there, it took, you know, more form as to how I was actually going to put the chapters together. Right. How was I going to do the table of contents? You know, so it was, those were the things, you know, the mechanics of the book. Writing the stories became easy once I put the pictures down and wrote around them.
Okay.
But the mechanics of the book itself, yeah, that was tough.
What made you decide at the end, or did it just come together for you as far as this, the size of the book, as far as, you know, the actual physical size of the book? Not the pages, but I noticed you went with a, what is it, a 9x10 or?
Well, I will tell you, because I published the book through Amazon, I self-published.
Uh-huh.
No one published the book for me. We actually talked to publishers, and they just wanted everything. I wasn't going to get any money. You know,
oh, God,
and they,
yeah.
And they wanted to do. Yeah. Oh, it was horrible.
And, oh, yeah. As you will. And you were so connected to the music industry, it works the same way, you know, so.
Yes, it does.
You
it
knew
does.
The scam there.
And so, yeah, we sure did. And they wanted to do all kinds of promotional things, you know, mugs and blah, you know. And so we thought, well, that would be really lovely. But, you know, who gets the money? Well, they do.
Yeah.
So we decided afterwards, we said, no, that's ridiculous. So I started looking into self-publishing. I took a class. In California by a man named Mike Rounds, and he has all kinds of stuff, even online, all kinds of stuff, books on self-publishing. And that's what I did. And that was also very difficult, you know, to educate myself on that.
Right.
And what to do, what to look for, you know, and scams and that sort of thing. Anyway, I went through Amazon. They have it's now called Kindle Direct.
Right.
It just used to be called Amazon something or other. I don't remember, but they changed the name. Yeah. And they have certain sizes. They're the ones who determine the size.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, there was another gal that I dealt with. She actually lives in Hawaii. She does formatting.
Right.
And so she would help me format the book. And she did I gave her the picture of what I wanted for the front of the page. And how I wanted it to look, and she designed it, and, you know, we went back and forth. And then the back of the book, you know, same thing. I had that silly picture that's on the back of the book that I thought was kind of fun. I said, oh, that'd be fun to put on the back because it's kind of kooky. And she liked it, and then we designed the back around that picture. So
I got to tell you.
The formatting. Yeah.
Yeah, a synchronicity regarding the back of the book. Here again. And I just have to laugh now because I see the synchronicity because of your experience of what you've gone through and how I was kind of in a parallel life but a different location on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But the back of the book, I was thinking, what am I going to put in the back cover? Oh, I know. I'll just list all my artists on the back of the cover. And I got your book and I'm going,
yeah.
That's what Linda did.
Well, you know, you want to draw attention to it. If you're selling the book in brick-and-mortar store, you know, as opposed to online.
Right.
People like to pick the book up, feel it, look at it, thumb through it. If they look at the back and they see it, now you may recognize or may notice that, yes, there's a list of all the bands that go flew.
Yeah.
But I didn't fly them all. You know, I didn't fly all those tours. What I flew were the tours that are actually in the book.
Right.
But it you know, whets somebody's appetite when they look at it and go, oh, wow, you know, as they're looking through, you know, all the different, my phone is beeping, so I'm sorry, distracted. But as they're looking through, you know, all the names, they can say, oh, my gosh, you know, this company flew all these bands. Well, these got to be, you know, good stories in here. So that's
right.
What I was counting on. Yeah.
Now, you didn't maybe have the same selections back when you released the book, but knowing what you know now, what's available, would you basically do it the same way as far as both self-publishing as well as the techniques that you use for the self-publishing?
I would. I worked very, very hard to figure out how to do self-publishing. That was a very difficult part for me. to get the book published. And like I say, I went through classes. I dealt with people online. To get all the information I needed. And to see what happens is, I don't know if you know how Amazon works. Do you know how they actually work?
Somewhat. I am in the marketing currently. That keeps me semi-busy on the site. I'm a search engine optimization, I guess you'd say, strategist. Mm-hmm. And content marketing. I help people with websites figure out why people are not engaging in their websites. I pull out little nuances why. And so I do have, a generic background, but I'm not totally up to today. I'm sure I will when I get close to that time of launching, but of getting heavy into researching what Amazon's up to on the publishing side.
Well, so do you know what POD is?
Yeah, publish on demand, yeah.
Or print on demand, as far as Amazon goes. Yeah. So what you do is you give Amazon, after they've published it, you give Amazon your manuscript, the whole thing, mm-hmm. in the cover, in the back cover, and so forth. And then, of course, you decide on what size you want, the coloring, if you want color. And, of course, my pictures inside are black and white because it would cost an absolute fortune to put color pictures in. I wish I could.
Yeah, I'm fortunate.
But, so if somebody orders a book online from Amazon, what Amazon does is they print the book. Mm-hmm. And then mail it out. So it's print on demand.
Right.
Now
your
the
cut's
problem
not
that
so
I have,
good, yeah.
The problem that I have found with that is what was happening, I ordered a bunch of books. I ordered like 10 books, just to have here because I sell them, to people who, ask me for a book. I sell it to them and sign it and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And some of the, twice, when I had books delivered to me, the pages, the pictures were so dark, you couldn't see even who the face was.
Oh, wow.
So dark. Mm. It was like they were printing on, it wasn't like the first manuscript. They were printing on, different copies of manuscripts.
Right.
And I had to put in a complaint, and they give you your money back. And then, I ordered some more books, and then those would come okay. The next time I ordered them, they came all dark. Mm. So I would look on the back to see where they were. They have different printing companies, who print these books. But I think it's just based on the generation of manuscript that these printers actually have on hand.
Yeah.
They should each have like an original manuscript, but they don't. So my concern was, if somebody gets a print on demand when that they order it, are the pages going to be dark? I have no control over that.
Right.
A book that the pages are really crappy.
Right.
So that's my concern. I had somebody actually put in a review of my book and talked about how dark the pages were. Like it was my fault. So
right.
Because they don't know.
Yeah.
They don't know. They just think that my book is crappy because the pages are so dark. They can't see who the people are.
Right.
So that's the only concern, that I have. But even so, if I were to take the book and put it in a regular store, a brick-and-mortar store, I have to get the books printed from them and deliver those books to the store to have them sell off the shelf, which mm-hmm. I've not done yet.
Right.
I'm just doing it strictly off of Amazon. And I didn't do Kindle. I didn't even do a Kindle. I probably could,
uh-huh.
but and probably should and probably – a Kindle, I'll probably get color pictures on a Kindle. I don't know how that works.
Right. Well,
I'm not looked into it.
Yeah. I think you get away with the color on the Kindle, but it depends on the person. If they're reading it off of certain tablet forms, they're not going to get a color because what was the tablets that just used for reading books? I forget the name of it now. Nook?
Or Kindle.
Yeah, the Kindle Reader or something like that. That would be more like black and white. But yeah, you could probably get away with.
Oh,
a lot
it would
more,
be black and white. Oh.
But I think you'd get away with a lot more color across the board because people would read it off their laptop or something like that. And that does, you're talking about marketing tactics. I noticed that you did have a blog at one time, but then would you let that go, I guess?
The website?
Yeah.
The website or my, Cliff, my husband, designed this website that was really terrific, and I had cards made that had a scan code on the back. You could scan it and go directly to it. But that didn't, that would, it cost us a lot of money to maintain it, and it really didn't get any hits. So we did away with it. Just forget it. So what I do is I was doing blogs on my Facebook page for Coffee, Tea, and Rock and Roll.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of helped. It kind of helped. I mean, what I was doing for a while was if it was somebody's birthday, I would say, you know, it's Robert Plant's birthday today. He's blah, 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 blah. You know, read all about, Robert Plant when I on my tour. Page so-and-so, you know, of Coffee, Tea, and Rock and Roll. And that's what I would do each month. Whenever there were birthdays, I would plug that in. And it generated some sales. But, you know, this is my book is from 2016.
Uh-huh.
So the sales have dwindled, you know, quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I used to get a big rise in sales for Christmas time. And I did a blog for Christmas this past year, but it went nowhere. I got just several books sold. It really didn't go anywhere.
Uh-huh.
So.
Now, with all the bands, because I've noticed just being, for example, in a Jimmy Buffett thread, I get a ton of requests, where's your book kind of thing. And I noticed that there's threads for every band, well, numerous threads for every band out there and every past band. Is that something that you have considered finding another outlet for your distribution of the book?
I would love to find another outlet for the distribution of my book, but I'm kind of at a stalemate right now. I really don't know where to go. You know, Amazon was doing good for a while, but it's not really doing so well anymore.
Yeah.
I would like, we have a little book, you know, there's a local bookstore here that Cliff keeps telling me to go in and, you know, you could always read from your book, you know, and you can get sales that way if, you know, local talent, local. We actually, Cliff and I actually did a, what are those things called? You know, those, they're outdoors you put up a tent and people are selling their wares and so forth.
Right. Yeah, like a farmer's market or something. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like a farmer's market.
Modified.
We did that one time.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We did that one time and it was a major failure. First of all, we didn't get a whole lot of people coming through. And secondly, a windstorm picked up and broke the canopy that we had. And, you know, we had to pack it all. And I really had it, you know, set up really nice. I had a, you know, one of those dummy things that you put your clothes on, you know, and women can make dresses off of them. You know, it's a form, a woman's form.
Right.
And a big tall stick. You know, I have a jacket, a tour jacket, Stevie Nicks tour jacket, and I put that on there just to, you know, show that we did tours, and I had pictures, and I made this, I actually ordered this thing that said, you know, come meet the author and get an autographed book, and, you know, we had a setup really, really nice, and my husband even brought one of his guitars. He put it on a stand so that it would just look like rock and roll.
Right.
That fell over, and he chipped his nice guitar. So,
good.
I mean, it was like a total disaster. Yeah. I had one person come in and want to buy the jacket.
No,
but it, So that was the extent of that. So we thought, okay, no. And of course, you know, you pay money, you know, to have a spot at this outdoor market.
Yeah.
So that was like a total failure. So we said, okay, no more of those.
Well, I would think somebody like you would do good on Facebook threads, actually hopping into threads for, you know, any. I'm using Jimmy Buffett as an example where I go in there and I just basically give little tidbits. I don't give, you know, full chapter information or anything like that. And just enough to tickle the crowd as far as giving them some information, insights, because that's all they're looking for is something to that they can, you know, have a way to reflect on their favorite entertainer. And I noticed that by doing that, that allows me in fact, I've talked to a couple of administrators for these fairly large threads, and one of them being Jimmy Buffett, another one being Van Halen, Grateful Dead. Those are the other bands I flew. But and the fact that if they're fine with you announcing or making an announcement or talking about the books available if you contribute to the thread throughout, you know, a certain period of time, which is just answering questions, or maybe somebody brings up a picture that, in fact, a couple times for me, they actually brought up pictures on the ramp with the airplane, the cheeseburger plane there, and somebody would comment, is that the plane he flew in? And I would jump in and say, yeah, that's that. I was actually the guy that put that together, and I could tell you a quick story about it. And I'd maybe put a quick paragraph, nothing long, but just enough to, mm-hmm. to pipe their interest up. And then knowing that mm-hmm. eventually when I get the book ready to launch, I can go in there and literally sell without seeming like I came in there and stomped on a personal, you know, on a thread type of thing. Well, I would think you would be very good at that, because of all the bands you flew, you could hop into so many threads and start building a because, you know, and you're not going to sell them all at once, but that's not the idea. The idea is to keep it sprinkled out there so it continues. You use the word consistently. It consistently sells your book.
Yeah, I have actually done that. There is a Chicago site, you know, where people are, you know, add to that thread and so forth, you know, blogging for Chicago.
Yeah, right.
And I've done that. You know, I flew the Chicago band, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's chapter so-and-so in my book, and give them a little excerpt. If it did anything, it did, because my book's already out there. So if it generates any interest, they can actually go to it and say, you know, available on Amazon, you know. If it did, it maybe sold a couple of books, but not much really. So, I mean, Facebook's okay, you know, to a certain degree. And then some people might look at it like, oh, there's a know-it-all, you know, this thing, she's a big, you know, you know, knowing so-and-so. And I do try to put it to relate to them, you know, to a certain degree. But once you start talking about, you know, I flew the band and they, well, you know, Chicago's on the airplane for a year and you know, you never know what, you know, how they're going to feel about that. So you have to be very, very careful, because a lot of people just think that you're just, you know, some big, you know, blowhard.
Yeah, I know.
You don't want to give away too much information either. You know, you want to say, this is in my book. It's on chapter so-and-so.
Right.
Check it out. It's on Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was the biggest thing I wrestled with for a while is, people, well, where's the book? And I go, well, what do people want to hear anything about me flying rock stars? And then I just got to thinking, well, if you write it in such a way that it's engaging to be like you're part of, I'm semi-writing some stories in part of my chapters. So they're actually feel like they're engaged, and it's not me. It's nothing about me. It's they're engaged with this story about this entertainer that they're interested in. It's such a dance. Yeah. I understand what you're saying.
It is. But if you, it depends on how you're going to write your book too. Like my book was my memoirs.
Right.
And a lot of people, you know, that's coffee, honey. And a lot of people, like I had one guy give me a review. He wrote on Amazon. He says, if you're looking for rock and roll, you know, this is not the book. You know, this is the Mother Teresa, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, one of the reasons why I actually wrote the book was because people, whenever I would say I flew rock and roll bands on tour, they would go, oh, you know, and they just automatically assume that there were orgies on the airplane and there was, you know, coke up the yin yang and everybody's getting high and it's all over the airplane. And, you know, and this is how they felt.
Yeah.
I'd say, you know, these people just sat on the airplane and buckled up when I told them to, you know, because I was there for their safety. No, there were no orgies on the airplane.
I know.
No, they were just people.
Yeah. You know? And you're right. They don't want to hear that they're reading Reader's Digest and playing cards.
Right? So, yeah. when, so my stories, some people had said, you know, well, this is the same old, and she said how nice they were and how this and how that, and they were just, they behaved and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's not rock and roll. Well, it was rock and roll. That is the life they lead. If they were going to have orgies and drugs and all that, they did it elsewhere. It wasn't around me, and it wasn't on the airplane. So, I mean, yes, they did drugs, but, you know, I didn't get into all that jazz. But there were no orgies. You know, we didn't have a pole in the middle of the airplane. I was pole dancing for everybody, you know. People, you know, I'm just a flight attendant taking care of people, passengers on an airplane, and I'm there for their safety. They didn't even need, you know, on the Viscount, you didn't even need a flight attendant.
I know.
Had them for the safety of the passengers and the airplane. You didn't want anybody doing anything to destroy the airplane.
Right.
Which they could, you know, if they were left unattended. But, yeah, so that was the one really rotten review I had, because he was looking for sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Right.
And I've even had interviews, you know, I've had radio interviews and so forth, you know. And I'll say, if you're looking for sex, drugs, and rock and roll, this is not the book for you. Don't buy it.
Right.
Because this is just about their life, what they do. And a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's looking into the lives of these rock and rollers and really what they do on an airplane, you know, because... Bye, honey. Tell Jim I said hi and Mary.
Now, before I forget.
A lot of people got it.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Well, regarding your old URL that's on the book, do you have the coffee, tea, and rockandroll.com?
I have that. That's.
You know, it's actually.
Oh, yeah. No,
I see that. I see it's still available. You might consider getting
My email address. You mean my email address?
No.
Your
old blog.
Oh, the old website.
But it's on, the website, but it's on your book as a reference, a contact point. You may consider grabbing that URL, because that's only like $20 a year, and having it 301 redirect to your Facebook page.
Oh. Okay.
Then that way, you know, you never know when somebody's down the road, they have the book and they go, I'll go see where this website is. And then it gets redirected.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can somewhat control, because you can't control the fact that all your books are out and already been published. So you can't change the website.
Right.
So that's just a thought from a marketing angle.
Oh, well, that's a very good idea. I didn't even know about all that. You know, like we just decided to do this website, and we had pictures on that with Flip, and it was very nice. My husband did a great job, and we tried to direct people to it, but it I even had a blog on there. You could talk to me and ask me questions, and not one.
Right.
Not one.
Yeah.
So we said, this is, you know, we had Bluehost, and it was, you know, like $400 a year. I said, this is not worth it.
Yeah.
It's just not worth it.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So that's another angle just to consider.
Okay.
I'd like to talk a couple flashbacks that we're talking here again, synchronistic events. You had, and which brought back a memory for me, which is actually a story in my book, but it's Ricky Nelson.
Oh, I loved him.
And I remember a few months before he had the unfortunate episode in the DC-3, his tour manager called me. And he goes, hey, Lofton, I need you to get me a DC-3. And I go, a DC-3 for who? And he goes, for my man Ricky. Well, he was going by the name Rick Nelson by then, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
And I forget the guy's name, but I said, I don't do Piston Twins, dude. And I go, I can give you, let me quote you in a Gulfstream 1, nicer airplane, much safer, same cabin size, pretty much.
That's turboprop anyway. Yeah,
it'll be, you know, he says it's going to cost me more. And I go, yeah, it's going to cost you a little more, but no, I want a DC-3. I said, I don't do Piston Twins, dude. And he goes, okay, well, We have nothing more to. I mean, I can't. I'm ready to give you money. I'm going to give you the business, but you're not going to give me the airplane I want. And I go, no, I'm not. Yeah, I don't. I just don't put my bands in Piston Twins. And
yeah, good for you.
So he ended up in a huff and puff. We talked for a little bit, and but then he hung up. And then on New Year's Eve, I got a call from a poker friend of mine. I was living in Big Bear at the time. And he goes, what do you think about the crash? And I go, what do you mean, what crash? And he goes, well, hadn't you heard?
Oh,
and I go, what do you mean? He goes, Rick Nelson just crashed in his plane tonight. And I thought he was pulling a New Year's Eve prank on me, you know.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe it. I go, oh, man. I maybe I should have tried harder to talk him into a Gulfstream or something.
Yeah,
but,
no. I had the same story. But it's not about Ricky Nelson.
I figured you would. Synchronistic. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, this was, what's the other band that crashed?
Leonard Skinner. Okay.
Leonard
and I
Skinner
have a Leonard Skinner
us.
One, too. Yeah.
Yeah. He called me. The manager called. And now we have the crewing company. So we dealt with the crew per day and the fuel per hour. You know, it was a cost per hour for fuel, and of course, a daily cost for the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ron Clark's company dealt with the airplane itself.
Mm-hmm.
So they would come to us for a bid, and then they would come back to us, you know, and then we would, you know, try and help them out, try and, you know, cut costs a little bit for them, give them a deal, and then, you know, back and forth. So finally, he came to me and he said, He goes, you have to cut, you know, the cost. He wanted a better deal. And I said, we can't. We just can't. We're at the lowest bid right now. We have to, you know, we have to have a cush, you know, for fuel and the crew. If the crew, you know, if you have to extend the crew time. So we're at the lowest. We cannot do it. So he said, okay, well, we're going to go with a so-and-so company. I for the life of me, I don't remember the name of the company.
Yeah, I forget who it was.
The one that they actually flew. It was, they were notorious, you know, for how bad they were, how they cut costs, how they cut corners, how they didn't do their maintenance and blah, 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 blah. And I said to him, I said, look, if you are going to fly with another company, please don't go with that company. I said, that company is notoriously bad. And he says, well, they got the cost. I said, you know, we have cut costs as low as we possibly can cut our costs. I said, if you go to another company who's going to cut the costs even lower, I said, you're looking for trouble because you're gonna run out of fuel. You go whatever. And the guy said, well, this company. And I said, look, here's the deal. If you can't afford us, please don't go with that other company. Choose another company. And he went on and on. And I said, all right, this is how bad. I said, I'm begging you, please do not go with that company. I'm begging you. Said, I wish I could cut costs more for you. You know, we cannot, but I'm telling you, we are a safe company. I was explaining to him how safe we were, how we hadn't had an incident. We've never had an incident, how our pilots are AMPs, how they can do, you know, blah, 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 blah. I said, I am begging you, do not go with that company. I begged him not to go with that company.
Yeah, well.
And they went with that company, and what happened? They ran out of fuel.
Yep. It's funny.
I did not put that in my book because I didn't want anybody to look bad. I didn't want to look like I was boasting, like you know, if he had gone with us, we'd have been okay, but I told him not to go, you know. So I just didn't even put that. And whenever I look at Leonard Skinner, I start crying. You know, when I watched the band and stuff, I was like, I begged this man not to do this.
Yeah.
Begged him.
Yep.
So you understand, know what that's all about. And
well, like, years later,
absolutely cannot cut costs.
Years later, I actually flew co-pilot on another Viscount that I leased. I forget who it was, and I flew the band's crew. It was a combi. We ended up flying actually some of the stage gear and the crew members. So it had a bulkhead with seats up front of about, I think it was two club seats. It might have had eight seats up front. And then the whole back of the plane was cargo.
I never knew anybody did that.
Yeah, okay. It was a wacky little thing. We flew from Phoenix to Toronto to Oakland in 4 days. It was one of those, you know, the pilots, you think we went to the concert, Linda? No, we were sleeping.
No. Yes, you bet.
But it was for Nazareth, the band Nazareth, and it was the crew members. And I remember talking to the crew. There's a funny story behind it. We got stuck with a thunderstorm in Chicago, and the FAA came out. And just to make a quick story, very short, because it is going to be in my book, but the FAA for the flying back into customs suggested that they could make us unload the whole airplane because it looked like we were running drugs from Canada, right?
Yeah, yes.
And the next thing you know, this was in Midway when it was like during the dead years, and there was only like one restaurant and one wing for
I know.
Yeah, so we found out that the crew were sitting there getting weather briefings, waiting for the thunderstorms to pass. We were wondering what happened to the customs agents and the feds. They're gone. Next thing we know, we walk up to the restaurant at Midway at this little wing, and there they all are partying in this room, the FAA, the customs guy, and the crew members. And they're all long hairs, you know? We're going, dudes, the weather's breaking. What do we need to do here? You know, and the federalities look up at us going, Lofton, this is the funniest thing in the world. You're good to go, by the way. What's his name? He points to one of the crew members, Johnny there. He's the best friend of my son that went to high school together.
Crazy.
You know, one of those little wacky things.
I'm telling you, it's all incestuous. It's all incestuous, and that's what I used to say all the time.
Well, the Nazareth guys that tied into Lynyrd Skynyrd, four of those six guys got off the Lynyrd Skynyrd aircraft the very first the flight just before the crash.
Wow.
They said, Michael, we just felt dark energy. We couldn't get on the plane.
I know.
So it's just
I think I even told you, and I said it in the book, there's a guy named Joe Vitale, who's a drummer. And
I know that name.
He was with a lot of bands. And that's what he would do. He would step up on the stairs. I think I said it in my book. He would take a couple of steps up the stairs, and if he felt, no, there's nothing, he'd get down the stairs, and he'd go and go with the ground crew. My husband, Chuck, at the time, I think he told me that Joe Vitale did that very thing on the Lynyrd Skynyrd flight. I think he was on it, and he got off.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, I know about all that dark energy and stuff like that, you know. But, we, as a company, we had a very good, a terrific, actually, record, you know, of we had no incidents. None whatsoever. Yeah. And if the airplane was deemed, you know, unsafe for any reason, we grounded the airplane. And, we had a belly fire in one of the airplanes in 2-4 Victor. I don't know if you remember that airplane. There was a belly fire in it. It wasn't huge, but it was. And that was an airplane that was at, I think it was Earth, Wind & Fire. And, of course, they put it out and so forth, and then turned the airplane around and came back, and then they put him in a different airplane. And 2-4 Victor was grounded for a while until they found out, you know, it was a little electrical fire. But, that's the extent that I remember of a problem on the airplanes. But the company had such a great record.
It's just a tremendous.
Flying with AMPs.
Yeah. I had no problem ever subcontracting with you guys. Like I said, the Buffett tour. I'm also reflecting on after they turned to Vossi when they went to Tucson, I think it was.
Vossi, yeah, Baikon Air Services,
I ended up
Vossi and he went to Tucson.
Doing something, I think, in a Viscount, but also I think it was a Paul Simon tour in a Boeing 737. Does that sound right?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Because Ron had some 737s that he was.
Yeah. He did. Mostly flying sports groups, sports.
Yeah, right. And I was also working through...
I don't know about flying any band.
I was working both through Ron and Michael Coward.
Yes, he's gone too. He passed away.
Oh, man. Now, Michael Coward lived in Lake Havasu.
He had cancer. Yes, he did. And then he moved to Tucson. But, yeah. Michael was fighting cancer for a long time, and he did pass away.
Wow. And then I remember, I guess this is a flashback, Linda, you probably, I have no idea whatever happened to that plane. Do you remember when Ron Clark flew into Burbank in that Caravelle, the French Caravelle?
Yes. Yes, I do. Chuck and I, actually, Ron had asked us to go check it out. We were on the road. And we went into the Caravelle, checked it out, and so forth. Said, yeah, you know, it's nice. What do you want to do with it, you know? And so... He bought it on our say-so that it was okay, and he flew it in. He never did anything with it, so, yeah. It just sat
We were in the Hangar 50, and we were working on the Viscounts or something, and we hear this tremendous roar of the reversers on that thing. What the hell is that thing? Yeah. And it ended up taxing over, and I go, holy crap. And Ron gets out. You know, it was kind of funny.
I still have pictures of it, because when we went to go look at it, we took pictures of it inside. I still have photos of it.
I guess it was a hell of a plane. It stuck around for a while, as far as...
I don't know. He never did anything with it.
No, I mean as far as they used it for in Europe a lot for airline work.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it had a much...
but I guess it just sat on the ramp,
Do you remember Jimmy Buffett, road manager, who is a good friend of mine, Bobby Lieberman?
You know, I don't remember his – I couldn't remember who the – we flew Jimmy Buffett only, you know, for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I never really got to get to – you know, 2 weeks is just not enough.
Right.
I just remember the guy, Fingers – they call him Fingers.
Fingers Taylor, yep.
Yeah, yeah, I remember him.
Now, he just passed, too.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he passed short a month and a half after Jimmy Buffett checked out.
Wow, isn't that something? You know, it's as we sit here and just watch all of these rock and roll, all the people that we knew, everybody's just kind of going, you know, and of course our time will come too. But, it's hard to think that, you know, we're getting so old.
I know, you know.
We look at these bands and go, oh my God, he's 82 years old. He's still going.
Did we ever figure we'd be at this stage, huh, Linda? Yeah.
I'm telling you know, Michael, I don't know if you realize this, and I don't even mention it in my book, you know, in that we, the people who flew these bands on tour with airplanes and so forth, we are very select. There aren't many people who have had that opportunity.
Yeah.
And this is why people want to hear about the stories, and they want a book, and they want to read about them, and they want to know what that secret life is all about. And there aren't that many of us who experienced it.
Right.
You know, it's a completely different world, unknown to many.
Yeah.
And that is what I tried to impart in my book, you know, or try to write to those, you know, who didn't know anything about it. And a lot of the reviews about my book were that I wrote in a conversational style. It is the way I talk, the way I wrote my book.
Uh-huh.
They like that. And also the fact that they learned a lot of things, you know, about these people that they didn't know before. And basically, they're just real people, you know. Yeah. And but it was unknown to them. That's the whole thing. You know, they didn't know what people do on an airplane. And really, there's people who's with them for, you know, months at a time. Like I said, Chicago is with them a whole year. You learn a lot about people in a whole year.
Oh, yeah.
Go through marriages, you go through divorces, you go through births of children, you go through, you know, all the holidays, celebrating all the holidays, and then trying to put the holidays on the airplane.
Right.
You know, you have turkey dinners, and for birthdays, I would decorate the airplane with, you know, balloons and gray paper and have a birthday cake. And, you know, you're just trying to make, well, this is what I did anyway, I tried to make their time on the airplane more like being home.
Right.
You know,
I noticed that. Yeah, that was definitely a theme that was through your book.
Yeah, well, you know, they missed home. A lot of the times they bring their wives on the airplane, you know, or their children.
Right.
Yeah.
I did get a kick out of another synchronistic event. I'm going to let you go here in just a minute. But
no problem.
The stewardess protocol. Firing stewardesses protocol.
Oh, yeah.
I just remembered the couple that I ended up firing off the Buffett tour. When I put the tour together, I was a single entrepreneur, subcontracting pilots and subcontracting stewardesses and that sort of thing. And I just remember when I read your little quip about, the stewardess wanting lewds or something like that, I just cracked up.
Oh, my gosh.
I remember having a couple on our tour that were just – it bottom line, they were fraternizing. They're fraternizing with the band, and it was just your basic protocol for us. If we're not flying the next day and we go to the concert that night, we might have a little after a gathering, but there's no going home with the band members. You get this?
Exactly.
I got it. And then, of course, and the band members, and of course the Stu comes back and goes, well, but he, I think we're really getting close. And I go to talk to the band member, and of course every time it's the band member's like, you could fire her as far as I'm concerned.
So when I train the girls, when I would train them, that's exactly what I would say to them. I'd say, you think that you're going to marry one of these guys? You're not.
Yeah.
And if I find that you're fraternizing with them and that kind of, you're out, you're gone.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the times what would happen, I say a lot of the times, it didn't happen all that much, a few times, yes. I'd get a call, and I put this in my book, I'd get a call from the manager, and I would say, we need another flight. They would say, we need another flight, and this one's not working out. And I'd go, okay, who'd she sleep with? And he'd go, she slept with the blah, 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 blah. And then, and then we don't want her on the airplane anymore. And I know, I understand. Okay, I said, she's fired. But, you can't fraternize with my flight attendants because you're causing them to lose their job if that's the case, So, we know. And I go, the next one I send out, hands off. She's there for your safety. So, and then usually I would just send somebody out who I knew, was a good flight attendant and that, wouldn't do that because they got it. And I always found that if you didn't, because, I get hit on all the time. If you didn't sleep with these guys, if you didn't, fall into that, because they always made it very easy, and flirted with you and you're the only one I want you kind of a thing.
Yeah.
If you could actually, stave them off, you became much closer to them in a way that you never could if you actually, went off with them. Because then now they're confiding in you. Now you're like their sister. Now you're like their mother. Mm-hmm. Now they're protecting you. If anything ever happens to you, God forbid, that person, would be gone.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I always try to impart to the girls. I'd say, look, if you don't do this, you're going to become closer to these people than you ever realize, if that's what you want. They're going to protect you. This was years ago when I first started out. They would make certain that I had a chair off to the side of the stage. No, this is our flight attendant. You sit here. Don't you want anything? They would bring me drinks. So, it was like I was their mom, mm-hmm. and they would take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would try to explain this to the girls and make you feel very special if you don't, because you've crossed a different kind of line,
right.
I said, but if you cross the other line, you're gone.
Yeah.
You're gone. You're gone. I'm not going to tolerate that. And I had some flight attendants who were with me for a very long time who got it. And they could write their own book today. But I actually contacted them, and I got information from them for my book. So you could do that too. Other people and pictures. There were some pictures in my book that I called upon other people. And I said, do you have photos? Give them to me, or they would scan them and send them to me. And I used them in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave them credit. you know, I would say at the bottom, you know, courtesy of so-and-so, photos courtesy of
sure.
so-and-so.
Sure, yeah, right.
So you could do that as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, if somebody, and also, for instance, the John Travolta DC3
mm-hmm.
in my book,
mm-hmm.
That DC3, you know, ended up, I think, in Florida. And so what I did was I called the Florida FBO, asked them if they knew where that airplane was. And they said, yes, it was. It was right there. And I'd say, could you go and take a picture of it for me and send it to me? And I'm writing a book. I will send you a book, you know, for your trouble.
There you go.
And yeah. And that's exactly what they did. They sent me the pictures of the airplane. It's just the hull. Mm-hmm. And I signed my book, and I was good for it, and I sent them a book. And there was another thing that I did the same thing for. I forget who it was. They took a picture of the airplane, and I sent them, you know, a picture. Now, I have another picture of, the beginning of the book, The Grateful Dead, I can't even think of the name of the band. The ones that did We're an American Band. Grand Funk Railroad.
Oh, yeah, that was gonna.
Book,
yeah, I was gonna.
My story.
Right. Yeah, your cave experience. Yeah.
My cave experience, which I never thought of. I told my husband the story, you know, many, many years ago. I was telling him the story about it, and he goes, "Well," and I didn't tell him about the cover of the album. I just told him the story, and he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I know who that is." I go, "You do?" It just surprised me. He goes, "Yeah, that's Grand Funk Railroad. I mean, that's an album." And I said, "Yeah. How do you know?" Because, you know, again,
yeah.
When I flew the bands, and I said this in my book, I didn't know who the bands were when
mm-hmm.
I flew them. So it really helped. It really helped me not to be, you know, starstruck. I would have to go out and buy their album and listen to the music and go, oh yeah, no, I know that song.
Yeah.
Okay,
same.
This is the band that did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that that runs in our blood as to how we were in that business as long as we were.
I suppose that's true, yes, yeah.
Because I remember with Jimmy Buffett, I had never heard of Jimmy Buffett, you know,
yeah.
And I ended up flying the guy personally for a couple of years and then handling his aircraft consulting for 10 years after that. And
he was a real down-to-earth kind of guy, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he was. Oh, and I was going to tell you the end of that quick story. That remember I told you we got the cheeseburger Fairchild? It was Hubbard Broadcasting Company.
Yes.
HB were the letters on the side of the airplane. One
okay.
day, just a few days before I went to pick him up on tour, I'm going, what the hell am I going to do with this HB? Okay, I guess I'm going to have to paint over it. I go, wait. I'll just take the left part of the H off, and now it's JB.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah, so that was
good. That
kinda,
is great. That's a good. That's a good.
Those
story.
Little, yeah, those
that's a
little
story for your book.
Those little synchronicity things. It's just like, like Grateful Dead.
Yeah,
I flew Grateful Dead for 18 years. Well, I didn't fly them. I was their flight consultant for 18
yeah.
years, and
right.
I never. Went to any of their concerts the first 10 years. I was living in Big Bear, and I was, you know, travel to get to the concert and all that stuff. And finally the tour manager goes, Lofton, are you ever going to fucking come out and see us?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I went down the long, I think it was like the Forum. I don't know if it was the Forum then, it might've been whatever it was about that time. And within 5 minutes, he's putting me backstage, sitting down, talking with Jerry Garcia, and I mean, we're talking
yeah.
aviation and airplanes, and they just picked it up from me that I wasn't starstruck. I was doing my business of making
yeah.
sure they're on the road
right.
safely. They get there all the time. They whatever they need. If there's a weather situation, I'm going to let them know that we're going to fly out sooner than later or whatever. And
yep.
that's
yep.
what I think they get from what you're describing is that nuance of I'm here to do the job and it's for safety. There's nothing here in the way. Of course, you know, like you just described, we're one of the few on the planet that ever experienced this.
Yes.
Which is grand, and it's hard to explain sometimes. So you just kind of keep it to yourself in a way. But
yeah.
That whole concept of, well, that's why I think that you were chosen to do what you're doing through some sort of universal law, that you're there to, like you said, protect them and do the job and not have any sort of starstruck getting in that way.
Well, it's, you know, again, there's a story in my book that we had just finished with Sting, and we were up near Canada. I think we're like way up north in Washington. I can't remember offhand. But Ron Clark had leased the airplane now to Disney because they were doing a movie called Three Fugitives. And so they needed to get up into Canada to do some filming and then come back down again, you know, into Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Nick Nolte and Martin Short and a little girl. They were the three fugitives. And so we had the crew, all the people that were on the crew, the producer, blah, 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 camera. And Nick Nolte showed up first. I mean, did you read this in my book? I don't know if you did or not, but Nick Nolte shows up first, and he gets on the airplane, and again, people kind of go, well, what did Nick Nolte do on the airplane? Well, he got on the airplane, and he sat in every seat to see which one he wanted to sit in for the few days that we were going to fly them. He finally found a seat. He sat down, and he's looking around. He's looking at all the airplane, and he says, I obviously had introduced myself to him. And he goes, Linda, how is it that you were in this area to pick us up? You know, how is it that you came to fly us? And I said, well, we were just on tour with Sting. We finished the tour, and we just happened to be here. And, you know, geographically, and you guys were in the area, and so we picked you up. And he looks at me, and he goes, this is a fucking rock and roll airplane? And I said, yes. And he goes, no shit? I said, no shit. And so he's like, wow. And so just then, Martin Short comes on the airplane, and I didn't know who Martin Short was at the time.
Uh-huh.
I knew who Nick Nolte was, but I didn't know who Martin Short was. So Martin Short comes walking on the airplane, and he goes, hey, Martin, did you know this is a fucking rock and roll airplane? And Martin goes, no shit. And Nick Nolte goes, no shit. So when, you know, you think about somebody like Nick Nolte, a big star in and of himself, he's mm-hmm. starstruck that this airplane is a rock and roll airplane.
Mm-hmm.
That just kind of, you know, that blew my mind.
Huh.
And so he's like, well, where does Sting sit? You know, I said, oh, he's at, you know, he's at over here. Blah, 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 blah. No shit. They want to know what seat different people sat in. And that always amazed me that these people are so huge in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they still can be starstruck, you know, for like somebody like Sting. You know, so that I took some of that and tried to put that in my book as well, or tried to write to those people.
Right.
So, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I hope
and
you
spoke
of
Sting,
of
and I know that the story that you talked about, the little rival between Sting and Robert Plant and the scratching on the table message.
No, it was Sting and Rod Stewart.
Oh, Rod Stewart. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That was,
but that brought them together. That story, you know, to me is funny because it had an ending
uh-huh.
in that they were rivals and it was the airplane that kind of brought them together. You know, this back and forth kind of thing with the carving in the table. Oh, I hated him for that. Carving in the table.
Yeah.
And, it just made me so mad, you know.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, in the book, I don't know if you remember, but it was the next part that we actually flew Rod Stewart on tour. And he sat where he did before when we just did the demo flight for him because his airplane wasn't ready.
Uh-huh.
And he went over there and he sat down and he was running his hand over the table. Do you remember that airplane? It was 89 Victor and it became 150 RC.
Right.
Did you remember that airplane?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Uh-huh. Remember the table that was inside. The sides of the table was all teak. And so that's what he carved in you know, the edge of the table as you're sitting in the, on that chair.
And when I got on these airplanes most of the time, Linda, I was turning left after the air stairs. I wasn't.
Yeah, no. Didn't you ever sit in there and have, you know, I always used to feed the pilots after we landed. They'd come to the back of the airplane, sit down, and I'd feed them all.
Uh-huh.
Didn't you get that? But anyway, so when he carved that, it was very long, very deep. And so when he came in and sat down the next time, he was running his hand over it like, oh, yeah, this is something to fix it. You know, it's all gone. And and I saw him do that, and I just, I fumed. I absolutely fumed. And because when he did it the first time, you know, the manager, Henry, who's also dead now, was in my face. You know, and every time I'd look to see what was going on in the cabin, he would move over.
Blocking you out.
Talking to me.
Yeah.
He was blocking me out, and you know, and I didn't even dawn on me that he was doing that because Rod was carving. So I whispered, I don't know if you know in the book, it says I saw him do that, and then I went over and whispered something in his ear. And, you know, he just kind of looked at me and nodded. I didn't say in the book what I said because it was ugly. But what I said to him was to Rod Stewart, I leaned over, you know, to whisper in his ear, and he turned his ear, you know, to hear me. And I said, if I catch you carving in my table with that penknife again, I'm going to use that penknife on you. And I backed up and looked at him. We were nose to nose. And I said, do I make myself clear? And he just stared at me, and he just slowly nodded his head up and down. And that was the last it was ever said about it. Because I was not gonna put up with this crap.
No.
You know,
yeah.
I'm here for not only for the safety, for your safety, mm-hmm. but I'm here for the safety of the airplane, that credents like you don't carve in teak wood, that this airplane is built in the 50s that was, you know, never carved in before.
Yeah. Right.
And we had to take a day of our time, our day off.
Yeah.
To go back to the airplane. We had to go buy the stuff and go back to the airplane, sand it down, varnish it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Our day off, you know, and now we have to go back. And he just, I mean, you know, you understand what I'm saying, where I'm coming from.
Sure, yeah.
And, and Rod Stewart was just never my favorite. He was always very kind to me, probably from what I said to him. And he was always very sweet, and I was very sweet to him and always got him what he wanted, you know, and smiled sweetly and so forth, but he was never my favorite. I mean, I didn't like the way he talked to his fans, how he dealt with them. Mm-hmm. I just thought he was an ugly person in general.
I had flown him once on a short tour. Well, I didn't fly him. I arranged the flight for him in a Learjet, and that's all I can remember about him.
Uh-huh.
And of course, as you know, when you're a consultant or doing the brokering, you're talking to the tour manager and the accountants, and you're not dealing with the artist directly in this case.
Right.
You are dealing with the flight crew, and they'll give you some feedback, of course, but
that's
so. Let me ask you, Linda, after you finished your book, did you have any further reflections that said, oh, I wish I would have maybe thrown that story into the book also? Or maybe if you ever did another edition, you would throw another story or two in the book?
Quite actually, that book, I gave it all I had and more. And I had to, like I say, I had to go outside of my book to, you know, my experiences. I had to go and try and pull experiences from other people. There's a few, you'll notice, there's a few stories in there that, like there's a story about a model Viscount, John Wiegan, who was one of our first officers. There's a little story, a little blip about his mother gave him a little Viscount, and, you know, who knew years later he was going to be flying that airplane back. There's just a couple of little stories in there that are not my stories. They're
right.
just stories that I took from somebody, rewrote them and put them in the book and, you know, got an okay from them before I did that.
Right.
And not only that, I also, somebody had told me that what you need to do is if you're going to use somebody's name in the book and so forth, get this paper signed that they give you. You give you permission to write about them. And I never wrote anything about anybody in my book unless I passed it by them. I didn't want, again, I made before I did anything, I made a pact to myself how I was going to write the book. I was not going to offend anybody. I didn't want to write anything ugly. I didn't want the book to be a book of confessions that, you know, I'm sorry I didn't do this. I wish I had done that. I just wanted it to be a book about my memoirs, how I experienced these people, my interactions between these people, not interactions from that person to somebody else. You know, they're my memoirs. And stories that kind of dealt with Viscounts. And again, as you know, I just try to talk about the Viscount itself, why a Viscount was used and not a jet for these little short hops, these tours. And I talked about, as you know, I just talked about the Viscount and what it meant to aviation. You know, how it was first in many areas in aviation.
Right.
So I wanted to uplift the airplane so that people would go, they flew in a prop airplane. You know, I want to tell them it was a turboprop. It wasn't just a piston. And, you know, I wanted to lift it. It was a rock and roll airplane. And nobody knows about the Viscount. Everybody goes, oh, the Starship. You know, the Led Zeppelin flew in the Starship. It was a rock and roll airplane. That airplane lasted maybe 2 years and then it was grounded. Mm-hmm. It was not safe, you know, and so I talked about the Starship a little bit. But everybody knows the Starship because it was, you know, a rock and roll airplane. It was a jet, and it was executive configured inside, and there was a bed in the back and a bar. Well, we had all those things too, you know, but people didn't know about the Viscount. So that's what I tried to talk about, you know, that it was the rock and roll airplane, you know, built in the 50s. Turboprop airplane. So that's, like I said, most people would say, what kind of jet did they fly in? They didn't. It's a turboprop airplane, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, a lot of people didn't think that was sexy enough, you know? Well, you know, when it comes down to bottom line, it's money, you know? So.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Linda, I really appreciate the time you've given me to go over it. And flashbacks, I'm just smiling all the time while you're bringing up some of the past. And just, it really, it helps me ground myself, no pun intended, to really proceed on my end to get this thing going a little bit further down the road, my book.
You know, you're going to be so happy when you finish it, Michael, because it's like it's an accomplishment. You know, there's a very small percentage of people who actually write a book, and an even smaller percentage if they publish it, put it out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you write this book and publish it, whether you self-publish it or have somebody else do it, it's a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment. And it's one that really deserves a pat on the back, even if you do it yourself. But you will feel so good to have all these stories off your back and anything else that you have on your mind that you want to impart to other people. It's really kind of overwhelming when you think about accomplishing something like that. You will be very happy that you did it.
Very cool.
I don't have another book to write.
Mm-hmm.
I do not have another book to write because I gave that one everything I had. And people would say, oh, yeah, book two. And I think, book two. I put all the bands I flew in there. You know, I don't have any other stories about any of those. I just don't. Unless I took stories from everybody, all the flight crews. Because after I wrote the book, somebody would come back to me and say, oh, you know, the story. And I go, oh, that would have been good to put in my book. But I don't regret it because I did what I did. I got no more. I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
But it's okay. I feel good about it. I feel good about my book and
like you said, that gave you reflection. It gave you release.
It did.
So
it absolutely did. And maybe you might feel the same way. I would be very interested to talk to you after you finish your book. I mean, I'd be interested to talk to you about anything while you're writing your book. If you have any questions, you can always call me. But I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say and how you feel after you've completed your book.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm going to go load my drums now.
Oh, yeah. See, I used to help my husband as a drummer.
Oh, then, until you got smart.
until I got smart, yeah. So I said to my husband, I said, couldn't you just play the harmonica?
Yeah,
jeez.
Exactly. Take a flute or something.
You know what setting up these drums and breaking them down means. And oh. So I used to help him with that, and he goes, he always teases me when he's around the band. He goes, yeah, my wife used to help me, you know, until we got married.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, now I do everything else.
That's funny.
Which is probably harder than doing your drums. But
yeah. No, my girlfriend does that. She goes, do you mind if I don't go tonight?
Yeah, I don't do stuff too much, especially when it starts at 8 and they end at 11. I go, no.
Yeah,
no.
And as you know, drummers like the sound people, first in, last out.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely. Yeah.
And that's why I think taking up harmonica is not a bad idea.
He does play harmonica, too. So he plays harmonica and sings. Yeah, he's pretty good at what he does. Yeah, you should check him out online. They're called Groove Dogs. Groove Dogs. A Prescott, because there's another Groove Dog someplace else.
Blues Dogs?
No, Groove, G-R-O-O-V-E. Dogs, D-A-W-G-S, Groove Dogs.
Oh, Groove Dogs, I got it.
Yeah, they're online. Groove Dogs of Prescott, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah,
very
it
cool.
Yeah.
Well,
all right, Michael.
Enjoy your moments.
Thank you. You too. If you need any other information whatsoever, give me a call. I mean, even if it's like on a band that you're writing about and you don't know too much about them, maybe I can give you some insight on them.
I really appreciate that, Linda. Thank you so much.
You bet. Well, good luck on your book.
Okay.
And again, you know, if you don't talk to me in between, I sure like to hear about, you know, after you're finished.
Okay, cool. Well, be well.
All right. Yeah, you too. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye now.